regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
And I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time that Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced. Thousands of books have been written. And yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is, and that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The motto of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, Countdown to Disclosure. This is Beth. I'm so happy to be back home. We've had a series of rebroadcasts because I've been out of town at Washington, D.C., visiting the National Press Club all week last week at the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure. I will never be the same again. And I feel our world will never be the same again. For the past couple of months, we've been reviewing the witnesses that would be speaking at the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure. And now that I've been there, I think I brought back maybe 3 months worth of material that can fill an hour or 2 hours every day nonstop from here until the end of summer. And after that, I'm hoping we have disclosure sooner than later, and we'll change the subject again, and we'll move into consciousness and other topics like that. I want to tell you about what transpired last week. One of the big things was we were looking for mainstream media coverage of the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure. And on Monday, we were posted in Al Jazeera and we were posted in the New York Post and Huffington Post. And there were 7 major newspapers on Monday. On Friday afternoon, we were posted in the Washington Post. And early Saturday morning, we made the New York Times. And I'd like to share that article with you. Visitors from outer space, real or not, are focus of discussion in Washington. By Andrew Seidens, published May 3, 2013. Washington. While President Obama was promoting an immigration overhaul in Mexico, 6 former members of Congress gathered 2 blocks from the White House to consider what they see as the enforced government secrecy surrounding another kind of visitor, the kind who come from a lot farther away. Every day this week, the former legislators presided over panels made up of academics and former, of course, government and military officials who were there to discuss their research on their own eyewitness accounts or unidentified flying objects and the extraterrestrials who presumably would have occupied them. Something is monitoring the planet, and they are monitoring it very cautiously because we are a very warlike planet, said Senator Mike Gravel, a former Democratic senator from Alaska who ran in both the Democratic and Libertarian presidential primaries in 2008. Mr. Gravel and his fellow panelists were assembled by the Paradigm Research Group, which says it is committed to ending the government's truth embargo on the existence of extraterrestrial life. The lawmakers were there in hopes that their presence and political credibility would be enough to persuade Congress to take the issue seriously. I've been exploring how we might get this issue out of the shadows of the lunatic fringe, said Roscoe Bartlett, a former Republican representative from Maryland. Before his defeat last year, Mr. Bartlett was known for sounding the alarm on the threat posed to the nation's energy infrastructure by electromagnetic pulse, or EPM, the shockwave from a nuclear weapon detonated beyond the Earth's atmosphere. Called the Citizen Hearing on Disclosure, the event might have been mistaken as advocacy for government transparency, and some of the panelists had impressive resumes. I've come to understand and appreciate the importance of open, transparent government and the power of truth, said Paul T. Hellyer, who served as Canadian Minister of Defense during the 1960s. We are not alone in the cosmos, he added. One reason the ex-members of Congress agreed to sit on the dais and ask questions may have been curiosity. Our country has trivialized it and made it a joke, has made it green people with horns sticking out, said Carolyn Kilpatrick, a Democratic representative from Michigan, who lost her seat in 2010. Now I find that it's much more than that, and it's not a joke, and there is scientific data that there may be something there. Another reason might have been the $20,000 the organizers said they paid each panelist, but they are still maintaining a healthy skepticism. Just because the government might have had a document about how to handle extraterrestrials doesn't mean there were any, said Merrill Cook, a Republican from Utah, who was twice elected to the House. The panels this week have been low-hanging fruit for the news media while President Obama is out of town and Congress is out of session, and not all the people who study UFOs think the meetings will help them improve their stature in Washington. There is something to this issue, and there is a serious side to it, too. But that's not what's being presented at this event, said Leslie King, a journalist and author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, a collection of firsthand accounts by people who believe they saw them. The conclusion that UFOs are proof of extraterrestrial life is misguided, she said, and the people who broadcast that belief hindered support for real scientific research. Despite the ridicule that usually accompanies the discussion of UFOs, they have been quietly talked about in corridors of power here. Some panelists at the event this week counted among true believers John D. Podesta, a chief of staff in President Bill Clinton's White House, because of his role in Executive Order 12958, which requires the declassification of most government documents over 25 years old. But the possible existence of extraterrestrial life is not exactly why he believes in government transparency, Mr. Podesta said. At the end of the day, there are going to be people who say that even if you did that, there must be other files that exist that you're not disclosing, he said in an interview. But objects in the sky have piqued his interest. In June 2011, the Center for American Progress hosted government officials from the Pentagon, NASA, and the Department of Transportation, as well as congressional staff and former officials from intelligence organizations for a briefing by Ms. Keene and experts from academia and foreign militaries. The private briefing was organized to discuss a proposal that the government establish a small office of two staff members who would selectively investigate mysterious skyward sightings and seek to understand them by applying scientific method. The proposal did not refer to UFOs, but rather UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena, as if those who drew up the proposal were keenly aware of how their objective could be perceived. They were interesting, credible people who had observed aerial phenomena that were unexplained and worthy of additional follow-up, Mr. Badessa said. Going back and looking at and declassifying whatever government documents exist is a smart thing to do. End quote from Mr. John Podesta. When this article was posted on the airwaves for everyone to see on the internet, then we were celebrating at the hotel, the volunteers, the witnesses, and some people involved in the project. And we were all together, and Peter Robbins was there, and he made a comment at the end. Peter Robbins was one of the witnesses, and he's an expert on extraterrestrial phenomena. And he said that he is probably the only person who has gone through the New York Times archives since the beginning of time and pulled every article they have ever written about anything to do with UFOs in date order and read them all in date order. And he said this was an extremely positive article and maybe the most positive thing the New York Times has ever published on the extraterrestrial phenomenon. So that was one of the main goals of the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure, was to affect change in the media and have intelligent articles written about the topic. So this was very exciting that we came across this. I would like to share with you what was said on the first day by Stephen Bassett about this topic. And I hope this loads okay. If not, I'm going to have to just give me a minute so I can load it again. Let's see. Here we go. This is Stephen Bassett from the Paradigm Research Group speaking on Monday, April 29th, Citizens Hearing on Disclosure.
The timing is perfect because we're just about done. You have asked what is perhaps the seminal question of our time, this time. How do we regain control? How do the citizens of the country regain control? And I would like to make a modest proposal. We went through an extraordinary period called the Cold War, nothing like it ever before. We built 86,000 nuclear weapons, six or seven countries. Four or five times we nearly launched them. It would have ended all of civilization, which would have been a killer on a resume, you know what I mean? We basically gave the government license to do whatever it had to do to protect us and make that not happen. And we built a vast secret, what I call, empire. Other countries did as well. The Cold War was over, and we won it. What we were supposed to do then was to, how would you say, reform, dismantle, readjust back to something more appropriate. We didn't do that. We kept right on going. And now this thing is out of control. It's like the guys that the town hires to come in and clean out the bad guys. And then when the bad guys are gone, it turns out the guys they hired may have been a problem. How are you going to get back control from a complex this vast that's funded by trillions of dollars? It's going to take a key, really, really big, a really big key. And I think there's only one that has a chance. And
everybody listen. Remember, NASARA is an acronym for the National Economic Security and Reformation Act. Now listen to what he's going to say next.
Presidents, we couldn't tell you before now, we're telling you today. I believe it will trigger the greatest age of institutional reform the world has ever seen, in which billions of people focusing their eyes in the same direction are going to try to adjust, reform every aspect of human society and try to get it back to where it should be. And that will make an amazing amount of wonderful television coverage. I'm looking forward to it. The age of reform, I think, is just on the other side of disclosure. We have to get through that door. That is how we get control back.
Thank you.
Fantastic. I am telling you, everybody, every minute of this conference, I don't want to call it a conference. That was a mistake. Every minute of this hearing was as poignant and monumental as what you just heard. So you may be wondering the ultimate question, what happens now? Well, it's important that we linger in this moment for a little while. Some weeks, I think. I would like to do that. You may have seen me on the video when I was there. While I was listening to the testimony, I typed in every word. You know, I'm a slow typist, actually. But I have transcripts from all 5 days, and I'm going to go back now, and I have volunteered to provide a full transcript of all the testimony to the Paradigm Research Group. I intend to use the transcript to disseminate more information about the citizens' hearing. The testimony of the witnesses is so vitally important. The comments by the Congress members was so vitally important. And where we go from here lies in those transcripts. So it's important to have that in print. I would like to see it posted widely on other websites. I'd like to see it posted on everybody's Facebook page. And I would like people to look through it and see what really was said. Some people have no time to watch endless hours.
Your audience, your participants.
Some people have absolutely no time to go back and watch hours and hours of transcript, but they prefer to pull up on their readers typed up transcript that they can read at their leisure the amount that they want to take in when they have a chance for a break. And that's why the transcripts are so important. The other thing I found out was, of all the experts that were there, of all the witnesses were there, of all the people who have toured and spoken to one UFO conference after the other for the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years, there was one aspect of this story that almost everyone had a different point of view on. Which is very unusual because most of the witnesses agreed on most things related to this phenomena because they've studied it for so long. The one issue they had that did not match up and still, I believe, holds us away from disclosure because of its polarizing effect is who are the others? Who are they? What do they want? And are we safe? So, as you all know, that's my expertise. I have gone into the ancient texts, found where they are speaking about the different species of extraterrestrials, and where they're speaking about where they've come from and what they want from us and who they are. So, that's what we're going to be doing on this program. We'll be looking into that question a little bit each day so that we can explore this concept and come to a more convergent opinion based on scientific research of what those answers are. Another interesting new development came about. I spoke with Danny Sheehan. I spoke with Senator Gravel, Grant Cameron, Peter Robbins, Gary Heseltine, Linda Moulton Howe, and all of those ones I just mentioned, and Steve Allen of the Stephenville, Texas incident. I spoke with all of those, and they have all agreed to come on and do live interviews on this program. So that will be a new aspect of this radio program. And Senator Gravel is expecting a call from me today. I'll start with him. And I hope to have others that I didn't get to ask at this conference also to come on. I would like you to hear firsthand from these witnesses the different issues that were brought up at the citizens' hearing on disclosure. So I have the transcript I'm working on. I was supposed to finish two books in April, and that didn't happen because of all my traveling. They got postponed. So both of those will be coming up in May. I have no doubt that I'll be able to finish both books in May. So the archives and the two books will take precedence next. And I would like us, we'll have the added interviews, the live interviews, and I would like us to take a close look at each one of the ancient texts and expand on what we were doing before and see if we can come to more of a consensus of who the others are, what do they want, and are we safe? So that's my plan. I want to thank everybody who supported me emotionally and financially and helped me make these trips possible. I hope to work hard and bring back to you as much information as is possible from what I learned. On Friday at the citizens' hearing, they showed a video which the producer and director of the Truth Embargo movie filmed with Tayu, their cameraman, and they took with them Richard Dolan to interview an elder man who's now living in a nursing home about his experiences when he was in the Army and when he was a deep undercover agent for the CIA. And in this videotape, which they presented, I'm going to share that with you tomorrow. Unless we have a live interview, I'll share it with you next time. And in this 15-minute video where Richard Dolan is doing the interview, this man says that he was working for the Army as a cryptologist when his boss came to him and said, "I'm in the CIA, and I was wondering if you would like to make a little bit of extra money." And he said to his boss, "I didn't know you were in the CIA." And his boss laughed and said, "Well, you weren't supposed to." And so he recruited him into the CIA. And he continued his work as a cryptologist undercover. But that's where his paycheck came from. And there were never any records that he was in the CIA. And he used a different name. And his job was to take the videotape that was coming in from around the world through Fort Belvoir in Virginia. And he was to look at the video of crashed UFOs and other phenomena, and then dispatch members of the CIA to fly around the world to these locations where the video came from and interview the people involved. Then he said, "One day my boss and I were called into Eisenhower's White House. And Eisenhower spoke to us and he said, 1 week hence, you tell everyone out at Area 51 that within the next week, that's the time allotment they have to come to me with a report with what's happening out at Area 51. And if they don't, I plan on bringing the Army in to invade Area 51, and we will find out what's happening there." So he and his boss took Eisenhower's airplane out west, landed at the Air Force base there, took a commuter plane to Area 51, and they were taken into the underground tunnels. And there they saw certain UFOs that had been recovered. They saw the U-2 plane, which was brand new back then. They saw early versions of the Blackbird plane. And they were taken in to see a captive extraterrestrial who had survived a crash, and they interviewed this extraterrestrial. So they flew back, and they went back to Washington, and they met with Eisenhower, Roosevelt, and Nixon. And they made their report, and they told of everything they had seen at Area 51. The thing about them, the hovering UFOs that were in hangars there, that they noted was that these UFOs had swastikas on them, and they were believed to be Hitler's UFOs. So this information got back to Eisenhower, and he said, "We have to keep this silent. We have to keep this a secret." He made his decision then. He felt there were grave implications that he couldn't share this with the public. And this event made all the secrets go deeper and darker down the rabbit hole. So as soon as I can, I want to share with you a presentation that talks about how this came about. And some people believe that Hitler was reverse engineering UFOs since the 1930s. And so I have a day planned where we're going to talk about these so-called Nazi aircraft because they're very important to the story of the secrecy. This doesn't get talked about very often, but more and more information is coming to light now. So, if you can just bear with me a second, I want to share with you a piece about our ancient history as it relates to UFOs, because we're going to have an ongoing conversation about this a little bit each day. Before I do that, I want to say that when I was in Washington, D.C., I got to meet our friend Hatem, who's designing the Earth Collective website. And it has not launched yet, but it's near to completion. It sounds like it keeps getting bigger and better. And so it was very nice to get to meet Hatem. His insights on collective consciousness and sharing that with the world are amazing. So I'll keep you updated on that. And I want to thank him for all his support to us and to the world for the project that he's working on and the other things that he does. So just give me a moment, please.
Genesis describes conditions in the world at the dawn of time.
There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Genesis 6:4.
Who were the giants in the earth, and what exactly were the sons of God mentioned in the text? While most English Bibles use the word giants, the original Hebrew word is Nephilim.
One translation of the word Nephilim is the men who came down, or those who came down, meaning those who came down from the sky. So it may not mean necessarily that they're physical giants. They could just be something like great heroes that came down from the sky and produced a hybrid race.
For many scholars, hoping to unlock the mystery of UFOs in the ancient world, the Bible contains other intriguing clues.
The Bible is full of UFO references that can be interpreted as such, and they were very well recorded. One of the best examples of classic UFO story is the story of Moses.
3,500 years ago, an epic period in biblical history begins when Israelite slaves are finally released from bondage in Egypt. Under the leadership of Moses, they begin a 40-year trek through the wilderness en route to the Promised Land. But according to the Bible, something very mysterious guides the multitude through the barren desert.
The Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light. Exodus 14:21.
Some believe the biblical passage contains another dimension to the meaning long cherished by most Christians and Jews.
Some people interpret the pillar of smoke and the pillar of fire that Moses followed through the wilderness as being similar to a cigar-shaped UFO. It expresses a theme of an extraterrestrial intelligence, some sort of advanced form of life and intelligence that's guiding man, something that's higher than man.
Some of the most intriguing biblical passages concern Mount Sinai and the handing down of the Ten Commandments.
Mount Sinai was covered in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke ascended as the smoke in a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked loudly. And when the voice of the trumpet sounded and waxed louder, Moses spake, and God answered. Exodus 19:18.
When Moses returns with the Ten Commandments after his encounter with God, or Jehovah, on Mount Sinai, his skin mysteriously shines with an unearthly glow. His hair has turned snow white.
The story of Moses has been tied in with an extraterrestrial encounter. His hair was turned white, which some have linked with the possibility of radiation exposure and so forth. It's easy to see how this could be regarded as a classic UFO encounter.
The notion that the Israelites may have been led to the Promised Land by some form of extraterrestrial entity has attracted many adherents in the last few decades. But understandably, scientists and religious leaders fiercely challenge the idea.
We're dealing very much with an interpretation, and we're dealing with an issue that I think has potential for being highly controversial, because after all, if you say that Jehovah is an ET, then that changes the basis of Judaism and Christianity in a very fundamental way. But it is a question of interpretation.
It's so easy to speculate. You can look at almost any story and find something that could have been signs of an extraterrestrial. But what you have to do, if you want to have such an incredible explanation, you have to have very strong proof. Otherwise, you're just gullible.
Hints at possible biblical connections with extraterrestrials or UFOs are not confined to the book of Exodus. In the second book of Kings, there is the intriguing story of the prophet Elijah, who lived around 900 years before the time of Jesus. While Elijah crosses the River Jordan with his son Elisha, a strange airborne craft appears.
And it came to pass as they went on and talked that, behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and parted them both asunder. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind unto heaven. And Elisha saw it and cried, and saw his father no more. 2 Kings 2:11.
in all ancient cultures, you will have descriptions of flying chariots of different kinds. For example, a chariot drawn by horses that flies through the sky and so on. In many cases, people today will interpret these as UFOs, that is, some kind of vehicle that flies under its own power.
Just over three centuries after Elijah's ascent into heaven in a chariot of fire, another strange incident occurs. This time, it concerns the Hebrew prophet Ezekiel. He is believed to have encountered alien spaceships on at least four separate occasions. In one account, he describes a clearly mechanical device under the control of human-like figures.
I saw four wheels, one wheel beside each cherub. In appearance, they were like sparkling topaz, and all four were alike, like a wheel within a wheel. They moved in any four directions, never swerving from their course. Ezekiel 10.
Based on the biblical description of the strange flying device, in the 1960s, NASA engineer Joseph Blumrich constructed this model. Is this what Ezekiel saw?
I don't know what Ezekiel saw, if he saw anything. One possibility is he was dreaming. Another possibility, he had some hallucinogenic mushroom or something of that sort. Another possibility is that he met another tribe that might have had torches and masks that were very frightening to him, and he just saw something.
This guy's a debunker, you know, with these all these specials. They're not really allowed to go on the air unless they throw in a debunker. So take him with a grain of salt.
Otherworldly that he couldn't explain, and so he made up this story that explained it as best as he could with the terms that he understood in his time.
Whatever happened during the biblical period, an intriguing question remains. Could UFOs and extraterrestrials have been involved in some of the pivotal events in human history? Artifacts discovered throughout the Near East speak of a time when humanity's ancestors came to Earth from the heavens. Hundreds of clay tablets and cylinder seals depict human-like beings with wings, linking them with the sky, and always conspicuous, the stars.
If you look at the ancient history of the Near East, and consider the Sumerians and Babylonians, you'll find that these peoples believed that their civilization was given to them by beings who came down from the heavens.
There's nothing in the historical record that is really conclusive. There are some intriguing stories in the records of Babylon, for example, but the human mind is so easily able to invent myths and fantasies that we have to take these ancient stories with a grain of salt.
We're taking you with a grain of salt.
Yet archaeologists have often pondered on the exact process which led to civilization as we know it. For it was with the suddenness of a sunrise that human ingenuity and engineering skills arose from the Stone Age and burst forth onto the landscape of history. The Sphinx and the Great Pyramid at Giza are two of the greatest enigmas of all time. The exact dates of their construction are still cause for debate. How did ancient people develop the technology to build the Great Pyramid with a discipline and precision still unmatched today?
The Great Pyramid of Egypt stands more than 450 feet tall. It weighs more than 6 million tons. And it has a footprint in excess of 13 acres. It's perfectly aligned to true north, south, east, and west. To achieve that precision of alignment with a monument on this scale is an extraordinary technological feat, and one that is continuously overlooked by our scholars today. Suddenly, out of nowhere, this extraordinary monument, a high-tech achievement by any standards, just appears on the desert. This is a great mystery, totally unexplained by conventional history, and one that requires us to use our minds and our imagination and intelligence to try to work out what on earth is going on here and what it says about the origins of human civilization, of the origins of our society, and our view of the past and where we came from. My sense is that we're missing a huge part of the human story. I think it's possible, indeed probable, that we are a species with amnesia, that we've lost the record of our story going back thousands of years before so-called history began. And I think if we could go back into that dark epoch, we would discover many astounding things about ourselves.
Egypt and the Near East are not the only regions where ancient ruins provocatively taunt the mind with the mystery of how they came into being. There are many such places. This is one of them. The great ceremonial center known as Tiahuanaco in Bolivia. Not as old or as imposing as the pyramids of Egypt, what makes this site so unusual is its unique location. Some believe that it could not have been built without intervention from a superior source.
The biggest blocks at Giza weigh 200 tons. The biggest blocks at Tiahuanaco weigh 400 tons. 400-ton blocks of stone used to create enormous constructions, 12,500 feet above sea level, in an area where it's almost not possible to grow any food today. The altitude is so high that the crops come out of the ground stunted. And yet again, we're asked to believe that this was done with massive labor forces hauling on ropes, pulling these blocks along. It defies belief to imagine that this was how it was done. You could not support ever a large labor force at that altitude. Whether we like it or not, we're looking at the evidence of a technology and one that we don't understand. Like the Giza site, the site of Tiahuanaco also incorporates extremely precise astronomical alignments.
Perhaps the most perplexing site of all in South America is the Nazca Lines in Peru. Covering more than 200 square miles, a bewildering pattern of gigantic artwork litters the Nazca Plateau. In addition to figures of birds, spiders, and animals, arrow straight lines stretch out to every point of the compass. Believed to have been laid down here more than 2,000 years ago, what was their purpose? Observable only from a great height, is this a canvas of signs and symbols etched in the sand to honor pagan gods? Or, as some people believe, do they contain hidden messages aimed at ancient travelers from the stars?
These are very remarkable sculptures made by essentially moving pebbles so as to change the color tone of the desert surface. It appears that many of these patterns of lines seem as though they're oriented towards the heavens in some way. We really don't know what they were for or what the or how they were interpreted by the people who made them.
I think that this may be one explanation, that the Nazcans were projecting these into the sky and using them for religious and ceremonial purposes. But the Nazca lines really do constitute a mystery. No one really knows what they were for.
Like so much of the ancient world, Nazca broods silently, its secrets lost in time. Ageless land of a thousand legends. It is also a continent of intriguing mysteries. During the 1920s, while exploring northern China, famous Russian artist Nicholas Rerich wrote of a remarkable incident in the Himalayas.
On August 5th, we were in our camp, and at about 9:30, some of our caravanners noticed a huge, shining, oval shape flying high overhead. It came from the north at great speed, crossing our camp before disappearing into the clear blue sky. It had a bright, luminous surface, brilliant in the sun. Nicholas Rerich, Travel Diary, 1936.
In the long history of this vast and beautiful continent, has the UFO phenomenon shaped myths and stories handed down from generation to generation? A brief glance at the texts of ancient India is revealing, for here too we find the haunting presence of strange phenomena observed in the sky.
Gurkha, flying a swift and powerful Vimana, hurled a single projectile charged with all the power of the universe, an incandescent column of smoke and flame as bright as 10,000 suns rose with all its splendor. The Mahabharata.
Compiled some 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, the Mahabharata is a Hindu poem written in Sanskrit. 10 times longer than Homer's Iliad and Odyssey combined, it is a saga of conflict on a cosmic scale.
The plot of the Mahabharata, which is the great epic of ancient India, has to do with an invasion of the earth by negative extraterrestrial forces. Basically, the idea was that governments of the Earth were taken over by beings coming from other planets who had the desire to control and exploit the situation for their own personal benefit. The story goes on to describe how godly forces intervened, and finally there was a great battle here on the Earth in which the issue was resolved and the negative forces were repelled.
Another epic poem, the Ramayana, was written more than 2,000 years ago. It too tells of conflict and conflagration in India's distant past.
The Vimana was a weapon so powerful that it could destroy the earth in an instant. It made a great soaring sound in smoke and flames, and on it sits death, the Ramayana.
Prominently featured in all these stories are strange flying devices referred to as Vimanas. What were they? Could they have been UFOs?
The Vimana is described in some detail, and its flight pattern is also described. It's quite interesting because it is very similar to the pattern of flight, which is described in the context of modern UFO sightings. For example, the Vimana would move in a very abrupt zigzag fashion. It would sometimes disappear from sight.
The earth shook, scorched by the terrible violent heat of this weapon. Elephants burst into flame and ran to and fro in frenzy. Over a vast area, other animals crumpled to the ground and died. From all directions, the arrows of flame rained continuously and fiercely from the Vimanas. The Mahabharata.
They were described as flying fortresses that were used for aerial battles. They also attacked people on the ground. They sent out missiles, according to these translations, interpretations. Sort of like a modern UFO report, except war was taking place.
Could great aerial battles have been possible more than 2,000 years ago? Compelling though the stories may be, were they fact or fantasy?
Okay, we'll stop there on that information. I wanted to bring again to our consciousness that we can see some stark comparisons between the story at Roswell and the stories in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, right? The story at Roswell happened in New Mexico, and at the White Sands facility, we had nuclear weapons. So where there was the largest installation of nuclear weapons on the planet, not far from that, we had a crash, multiple crash sites of UFOs in 1947. A few months earlier, in February of 1947, we had Admiral Byrd flying into inner Earth. And what did he find there? He found the German extraterrestrial ships that had swastikas painted on them. Then on Friday at the citizens' hearing, we had testimony from an undercover CIA agent saying that when he and his boss went out to Area 51, they found hovering crafts with swastikas on them. And this information was enough for Eisenhower to decide to keep everything in secrecy. Because otherwise, how do you explain the connections in the world to the nuclear weapons which we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the war that we were in battle with the Germans, and now the Russians? It is a parallel to the Mahabharata story, where they're describing nuclear weapons. That story is 5,000 years old. And the Ramayana, which testifies about the Vimanas, or the flying cars, as they called them, or the flying cities, as they called them, the motherships and the shuttlecraft. So this is a continuing saga from the beginning of time. And the only way to end it is to do away with nuclear weapons, stop weaponizing space, and tell the truth about our involvement with the extraterrestrials. That's where we're headed. Disclosure with a little d, the event disclosure with a little d, has happened. You are watching disclosure unravel before your eyes. Now, the only way we'll have disclosure with a big D is by an announcement by a head of state. So, Barack, I hope you're listening. This invitation is for you. If the United States isn't the country that discloses from you, Barack Obama, it will be extremely embarrassing, don't you think, to have the head of state of China, for an example, come out with this before you? Because you'll have no choice after that. You'll have to follow suit closely on their heels. So disclosure with a big D comes from a head of state And we know that Barack Obama is the disclosure president, and he has been preparing this for 1,000 lifetimes, and we know that the word will come down from Ashtar and Sananda when the timing is right and when we're ready. We made a big step in the right direction last week. We engaged with our government on the topic, and that testimony can never be withdrawn. So it was a wonderful thing. Thank you, everybody. Will you please join with me now for a guided meditation? Think about it. If we dissolve ego and every woman, child, and man on the planet were to integrate meditation and contemplation into their daily lives, what kind of world would we have? So to emphasize the importance of meditation, I'd like to share a guided meditation with you as often as possible to finish out our programming. This meditation is called Moonlight Over the Lake. I'm just going to bring up a little quiet music in the background to help set the scene. Just take me 1 second to get that. Okay. Make yourself comfortable, everybody. Choose your preferred relaxation. It is a warm summer evening. You are walking along the shore of a small mountain lake. The lake is deserted, except for a lone fisherman casting from the shore. The sun is sinking fast behind the silhouette of trees on the far shore, throwing its last rays of light across the water, allowing a swarm of insects a last dance in the golden light. Then even that fades away. There is a moment of perfect stillness in the silent twilight between day and night, except for a light splash of a fish or frog and the last sweet notes of a bird's evening song. A full moon has risen, its light reflecting on the still lake. The night is filled with the sweet fragrance of pine, and you feel the worries and concerns of the day slipping away. All is still, and you are flooded with a warm feeling of contentment and peace. You perceive a sense of harmony between yourself and your surroundings. You are keenly aware of the inherent connection that exists between yourself and your environment. It reawakens your sense of responsibility to do your part, just your part, to cherish and preserve the beauty of moments like these on the overall importance of being gentle and caring with our Mother Earth. Reflect on this thought for a moment. Slowly let the image of the mountain lake fade away. Become aware again of your surroundings and notice the feel of your body. Take a few slow and deep breaths and stretch your entire body. When you are ready, open your eyes. Take with you the thoughts and lessons you have learned during this moment of quiet reflection. Okay, everybody. That ends our program for today. I'm going to get back to transcribing what was said at the citizens' hearing so we can all share it. I look forward to our presentation tomorrow, and I hope you'll join me then. Have a wonderful day. Namaste.